Hi everyone, welcome to episode 197 of the Professional Book Nerds Podcast, presented by Overdrive. This is Adam, and I'm not joined by Jill today, because she's off doing a fancy author event at her alma mater. So instead of doing this by myself, I brought in our buddy Christina. Hey Christina!
Hello, hi!
There it is. I just want you to be able to say that.
Go Jill!
Christina and I were using our inter-office IM tool, Slack, to talk back and forth, and I knew I had to do this, so I was like, hey, instead of slacking, will you just come talk to me? Also, she has a, we have these really fun things that you get put in front of your microphone so that your P's and your B's and everything don't sound terrible, and it's like right in front of her whole face.
Yes, peanut butter.
So today, the main meat of today's episode is an interview that Jill and I did with this wonderful author named Malu Halassa, and I will explain a little bit about that in just a bit, but I figured since Christina's here, you could talk about what you've been reading.
Sure. So the last time I was here, I talked about my New Year's, my reading resolutions for 2018, and my goal is to read 2 books a month, mm-hmm. which I'm hoping I read more. I read in January Astrophysics for People in a Hurry by Neil deGrasse Tyson, and it was amazing, and I feel like I can explain astrophysics to anyone who's interested.
Uh-huh.
And there's this series on Netflix called Cosmos.
Yes.
And that's been amazing, too. So, again, I really could...
And that's also Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, and there's trippy visuals. So I feel like Astrophysics for People in a Hurry is the Cosmos without the visuals. So both are just like...
So, okay, here's my question for you. Because we actually just did an interview with someone who it'll be on a little bit later this month. His name is Chris Ferry. He does all of the, like, quantum physics for babies books. And... I actually told you earlier today I'm getting them for your eventual child.
Surprise, I'm pregnant!
Surprise, Christina's pregnant. I, like, panicked. I was like, wait, did we say that on the podcast?
I think I did a couple. I think I said it, like, under my breath in the resolution.
Okay. Wow. So, but because of that, actually, this Chris Ferry, who we'll have on later this month, he was talking about this book, too, because he was listening to it, because Neil does the narration as well. So did you listen to it, or did you read it?
I just read it, but I imagine, just having watched some of the Cosmos, he... is so engaging. To be honest, like, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry is not the most exciting stuff, but the way Neil writes it is, I feel like he has the flair for fiction, but he's telling you something you should know, but he's amazing. And Quentin named his son after Neil deGrasse Tyson. I did not know that.
I didn't know that. Quentin. Oh, he was just on. He'll be on in the near future, or next week, because we're doing, this week, because this is coming out Monday. We did another comics one. Yeah. Now, this is going to sound like a person who doesn't read type of a question. Are there pictures? Like, do they have illustrations?
Yeah, there's yeah.
I feel like, and I'm not saying that as a cop-out from a book standpoint, because obviously I'm a heavy reader too, but, like, I feel like I'm so dumb from a science standpoint.
No, there's definitely, there's pictures, but I don't know if you need them. Like, he does a really good job.
Okay.
Description-wise. Like, it's not, like, over-the-top, blow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You won't. It's really interesting. So
he also has a world-class mustache.
He really does.
Good stuff. You have another book too, right?
I just finished Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all talked about this here at Overdrive. I think everyone who's read it has loved it because it is, and it has nothing to do with the fact that it is based in Shaker Heights, Ohio, which is right outside Cleveland, which we all know about it. Obviously, there are names in places that I recognize, but you don't have to be from Cleveland to appreciate the book. I mean, it's
right.
Goodreads' best pick of 2017 for fiction. I had that classic case where I started reading it because I had heard so many good things, and then got to, like, chapter 4, and I was kind of like, I don't know. But then it's amazing, and I'm mm-hmm. glad I stuck with it.
I always struggle with that, especially when it's books that people have told me that they like reading. Because I'll get to a certain point and I'm like, well, other people said it was good, but then we've had multiple conversations now here where we're like, well, when should you give up on a book? So
I say my rule is 4 chapters. I have to read at least 4.
Mm-hmm.
And if I haven't decided by chapter 4, I should stick with it. But I've never had a book that I have finished that I regret. That's not true either. There's been definitely a couple books that I finished that I was like, should have quit at 4. But
I have found that I'm more likely to give up on an ebook than I am an audiobook,
mm-hmm.
because an audiobook just keeps going, and it's like I almost exclusively listen to audiobooks now. As like, I have stopped listening to most podcasts. I'm really listening to music either, just mostly mostly audiobooks. But like, I'll zone out for a few minutes on my way home and I'll be like, oh crap. But like, if you know, that would be a normal time in a book or an ebook where I just might have put the phone down
or skim, and then you're like, wait, I could learn something.
Or if I'm on the one problem when I'm on an ebook and I'm not like bashing Overdrive, it's, everyone talks about this, but it's like, oh, I wonder what's on Twitter. And then 20 minutes later, I'm like, one more meme.
Then I'll go back.
Yeah.
Well, and I think with some of the audiobooks too now, we get such talented voice actors. You know, I read or listened to Where'd You Go, Bernadette as an audiobook, and it was amazing. It's, I forget the voice actor's name, but they were on Gilmore Girls, and just the voice was perfect. And
yeah,
it should be. I feel like everyone who wants to read that book should listen to it because it's so well done, and she just captures the voice of both the young narrator so well and the mom, and it was really good.
I actually have a tip for people who are listening to audiobooks who are trying to get through more books. So everyone has talked about on this show, like, oh, they read it 2 times the speed or whatever, but it's hard to get used to that kind of stuff. So what I did is, like, 6 months ago, and I really got into audiobooks really heavily, I turned it up to like 1 point, because in Libby you can literally do like percentages. So I did like one, basically what would be the equivalent of like 110% if 100% was normal speed, and then like the next book I would do like 1.15. And, like, I keep working. So now I'm at like 1.5 times speed.
Yeah.
And it, to me, it sounds normal because it's, I've been just like gradually increasing.
You start to like adapt to your preference.
Yeah, exactly. And so now, like, I don't think I'll ever get to like Megan is, where she does 3 times the speed. That's bonkers. But I'm like at 1.5 times, and I'm cutting these books in half basically, and I don't notice a difference because I'm slowly increasing. So I'm curious how far I can get, like, speed-wise, until I'm like, all right.
I can't even. Chipmunks. Well, Andrew and I were talking about this. I listen to about an audiobook a week, but I don't count it into my Goodreads. And I don't blame anyone, before I get, like, hot takes about this, I don't blame anyone who counts audiobooks as reading. I do count it as reading.
I do.
But I listen to it because it entertains me, but I don't fully listen at work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like I am listening to music where I'm kind of, like, I hope, like, in my mind, I'm absorbing something. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm learning something, but I don't, like, I did accidentally listen to my first Abridge audiobook.
Oh, I've never done that.
It was an accident. Listened. I had no idea it was until I got to the end, and I was like, that was 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And then I went and looked it up, and it was like, oh, no, it's actually 13 hours. I got the Abridge.
Yeah. I do count mine in my Goodreads, but that's just because the majority of my listening to audiobooks is when I'm driving or running or walking my dog.
You actually listen.
Yeah,
I
actually
just kind of, yeah. I skim listen. Mm-hmm. So, and I try to pick books that I've either read before, so it's already something I've counted, or it's a book that I'm like, ah, like,
yeah.
The Art of Tidying Up.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to that, and I like to think it's made me a tidier person, but I also think the narrator is just really soothing. So...
Should have my wife listen to that.
It's like yoga.
I just lost my train of thought, and it's gone forever now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you know what you want to read next?
Yeah,
sorry, since we're in February?
I am reading, I just checked out Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. It's historical fiction based on this orphanage in the South where this gentleman was collecting children to sell to rich families.
Oh.
And... like kidnapping them. Mm-hmm. And it's, I guess, the story of this family in the past that was torn apart, these 4 siblings that were sent to this orphanage, and like they never see their parents again. And then in the nearer future, when a daughter is figuring out that perhaps where she came from is not what she always thought.
So, oh, interesting.
It said it was similar in vein to The Nightingale, which was my favorite book of last year. So set myself up to cry.
Yeah.
It's gonna be great.
Well, you're not super emotional right now, so
no,
it's totally fine.
No, I don't cry at all. It's great.
Yeah. Okay, that's awesome. So the rest of this podcast episode is going to be an interview. As I mentioned, Jill and I talked to Middle Eastern author Malu Halassa. She was on a book tour. She lives kind of in Ohio, I think. Kind of in Ohio? You either do or you don't.
Good geotracking.
Yeah,
she's
Jesus.
Kind of.
I think she lives in Ohio, and she was doing a book tour in Ohio and other places. But her book is called Mother of All Pigs. And if you're trying to stretch something to fit into your book riot, read harder challenge, you could sort of do it about nature because one of the main characters is a pig. So that's like a...
I know in my read harder challenge, I'm like really kind of like squeezing things in there.
Right?
Like, it's like, I feel like I'm in college again trying to like cross-reference my courses. Like, can I make this work?
Well, there's another one that's read a book with a female protagonist over the age of 60. And I was trying to remember, so there's several... quote-unquote female protagonists in this. It's all about this family, this large Middle Eastern family who lives in the Middle East, and I can't remember if any of them are over 60, and I was like, well, that might work too. So if read it, and then you can decide how you want to, if you do that. Regardless.
Just read it regardless.
Yeah, it's really, it's entertaining, it's educational. I wouldn't normally pick books about the Middle East, just because they're not widely available, or unfortunately they don't get a lot of attention, but this one, she's from an independent, like a small publishing house, and I'm so glad they reached out to us, and they sent me a copy just like out of nowhere, and I'm really glad they did, because it was one of my favorite books last year. But we learn a whole bunch about stuff in the Middle East, and she did all this research about pigs. That's adorable. I don't want to give away, I'll talk to you about it after we start this recording, because she talks about it in the interview. But
I love when authors go that extra step and you learn, like,
yeah.
Jodi Picoult does that.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, Lulu Halassa was wonderful. I really hope that you guys pick up Mother of All Pigs. If it's not in your library's collection, I highly recommend you recommend it. Yeah, it's really good. If you want to reach out to us, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ProBookNerds. You can also email us at ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com. Christina, is there anything else you would like to talk about?
No, I have nothing.
Okay, wonderful.
I mean, I always have something, but I could go on and on, and I don't want to.
Well, thank you for pinch hitting. I appreciate you
stepping
in. You're welcome.
I'm happy to do that baseball thing.
All right, well, I hope you guys enjoy this interview with Malu Halassa on the Professional Book Nerds podcast. Hi, everyone. It's Adam and Jill again, and today we're joined by Malu Halassa, who has been writing about the Near and Middle East for The Guardian and other publications since the 1990s. She's edited and curated several books, including Syria Speaks, and her debut novel, Mother of All Pigs, is now available. And most importantly, she's here in person with us. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm very excited to be here.
Can you get us started by giving our listeners a brief introduction to Mother of All Pigs?
Mother of All Pigs is a family saga that takes place in an unspecified town in Jordan. Within the household, there are three generations of women, but also this is a family that would have, you know, stayed with each other, and really nothing would have happened in this small town, except that it's a town that's having a lot of visitors. People are passing through. And not only are different characters passing through, also a non-human character comes into the town, which is the pig.
I'm going to ask you about the pig, because there's some stuff that I love about the pig. But you've covered and reported the Middle East extensively for, like I said, several years, many decades even. And I'm curious what made you want to write a novel at this point.
I think I was really interested in that because of my nonfiction anthologies that I've co-edited and worked on, and the sort of journalism that I've done. I feel that you present the Middle East on a certain kind of platform. And I was curious about, because I come to the Middle East through two prisms. One is all the work that I've done, but also because of my family. I come from a Jordanian family. I was interested in being able to tell a story about the Middle East. And I was curious if people would respond in a different way to a story, a fictionalized story, as opposed to nonfiction, where it's really a platform for new writing and images from the region. Mm-hmm. And I'm on this book tour, I'm learning that, yes, people respond differently to fiction than they do to nonfiction.
So, you know, as you just said, you have extensive knowledge about this area, both from the research and the previous work you've done, and also through your family. What was the research process like? You know, were there things you needed maybe to learn about more that you hadn't known before?
Well, I think that because of some of the work that I've done in the Middle East, for example, there's another book that I've done called The Secret Life of Syrian Lingerie, Intimacy and Design. That brought me right into the sexual mores of the Levant, and how men and women interact over lingerie. That was something that was really interesting, and that kind of fed into the novel somewhat. So my experiences in the Middle East have definitely informed and emboldened the novel, but I also sort of feel that the family did, too, give me a particular insight inside. So both together, I think, really made it. Tell me the question again.
No, I was just wondering if there's a research process involved in writing fiction. You know, if you brought that to the story?
Definitely there was a research, a process involved into writing fiction. I might know the Middle East, but I didn't really know about pigs.
Okay.
And the reason I chose a pig was that my uncle, many decades ago, he tried to raise pigs in the mountains of Jordan. And my cousin Katrina, when she was 10 years old, she went to see the pigs. Now, I never saw the pigs, mm-hmm. so they kind of loomed in my imagination. But I didn't really know about the life of pigs. And so I really spent a lot of time monitoring pigs. In London, where I live, they have these city farms. So I was able to have a close relationship with a pig at the Hackney City Farm, watch it get pregnant, be there for the birth, all of that. But what really clinched it was that at the tail, after I'd handed in the draft of, really the final draft to the publisher, I had all these ideas about pig psychology because of my research. You know, there's a lot of research about pigs, whether they're farming them, whether they're killing them, whether they're eating them. But I had an idea that pigs acted in a psychological way. You know, they say that pigs have the intelligence of a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if they have this intelligence, there's something else going on. And so I interviewed the show pig exhibitors on the Isle of Wight.
I love this.
They're called Sharon and David Groves. And I mean, they told me the life of their pig Goofy, who was an award-winning pig.
Oh my God.
And how that, you know, when they first met Goofy and they took him in a truck and they brought him to their place where they kept their pigs, that they arrived in the middle of the night and they just opened the door and Goofy just ran out exactly to where Goofy had to go. And in terms of making a nest, deciding where the wet spot would be, where the toilet place would be, you know, all these things that the pig was deciding. Also, what was really interesting to me, I mean, if you want me to go on about pig psychology.
I will listen to this for as long as you want to go.
What's really interesting about pigs, like when they're getting ready to slaughter pigs, the chute down is curved so the pigs do not see the next pig getting killed, because once they see that, a stress hormone destroys the flavor of the meat.
Oh my God.
So I was thinking that my character is a pig that is, through artificial insemination, is really becoming the pig that pumps out all the piglets, and some of them disappear. So I'm sure that this mother of all pigs knows that she's missing some of her young. And what is the effect of that? And hanging out with the pig show exhibitors, they said I was exactly right. That my sort of imagination, my imagining about pigs was true.
So, okay, I want to talk about show pigs because I've never heard this. Is it like similar to like a dog show? Like,
they do tricks. They're brought into an arena.
That's in Babe. Isn't that in Babe? He's like a show. Well, that's a dog, but he is a pig. Who like
but
goes
this is,
to
I think this is different, though, because Babe the pig is doing dog show things.
But it's
this...
the same idea, though. Yeah.
Well, I think that definitely these show pigs, they do various things. And Goofy would not, when Sharon and David Groves were training Goofy, Goofy did not want to perform for them. However, in an arena, Goofy did everything perfectly and won prizes. So, you know, there's something interesting about pigs. They can be a little bit, you know, difficult to, you know, psychologically difficult, but on the day,
sure.
they want to perform.
I love,
wow.
This is so, and I mean, I think I get it because they, like you said, people always mention when discussing pigs that they're very intelligent creatures and lots of people do have pigs for pets.
Yes.
And, so I get it. I can see it. It's just fascinating. Also, Goofy might be my favorite name of a pig I've ever... That's a wonderful pig name.
That is a wonderful pig name.
Okay, we'll get back to pigs, but we should probably talk about more stuff than just pigs, I suppose. there is a setting in the book, The Marvelous Emporium.
Yes.
I'm so fascinated by it. So two questions. One, can you maybe explain to our listeners just a little bit, like, kind of paint the picture of what that place is, and then... I'm curious if that is a place that existed that you kind of visited. So I'll be quiet and listen, I promise.
Well, the Marvelous Emporium is a very large garish shop on the main street of this Jordanian town. It has everything. It has, you know, Far Eastern strange foods, but also designer clothing, also everything that you can possibly think is in the Marvelous Emporium, and it's stuffed in the shelves, mm-hmm. and it's very cavernous, and there are many rooms to go into. And have I seen this place on my travels? Yes. When I did my first story in the Middle East by myself in 1979, in my early 20s, I was moving between Damascus and Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War. It was a time when the borders were very porous, and you might not have a Lebanese visa, but with the right people, they could get you in. I was moving among the Palestinian fronts at that time, and I think it was a colonel from Al-Fatah who had a Romanian mistress and a big car, and Al-Fatah said, they knew I was moving around between cities, and they said, whenever you want to come to Beirut, just go present yourself at this office, and you'll travel with this gentleman will take you across. And so I noticed that I went with him several times, but he would always stop in Zahle, which is a town in Lebanon's Bekaa, which is the breadbasket of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, this sort of garish emporium with everything. And this gentleman would fill his car up with goods. Whether he was coming from Damascus or going to Damascus, he would just fill it up with goods, and I'm sure that he was selling it on either side. And that's where I really got the idea for the Marvelous Emporium. But in Mother of All Pigs, the Marvelous Emporium has another function other than being this garish shop with everything in it. I really see it as a memory machine. Mm-hmm. And so it's really through the goods and services that are offered there, and also some of the hidden nooks and crannies, mm-hmm. where there are certain museums that are kept, that it's through the Marvelous Emporium we get the history of war and conflict in the region, the wider region.
And you also get, you see kind of like the, not almost like an opportunist, the way that you can, that people can be opportunistic about any circumstance in life, because like you said, you get the history of all these different wars and conflicts and everything, but the reason you get all those is because one particular character was very much aware of, you know, almost like an entrepreneurialism of, I can make money off of
each conflict.
Yeah,
yes.
It's really an,
and that's Abu Zatar.
Right.
And he's our corrupt black marketeer who is within the Sabas family. He's one of the relatives on the side. Mm-hmm. And yet his influence over the family is complete in a way.
Yeah.
And he sort of leads the erstwhile patriarch of the family, Hussein, down a controversial road.
That's a fair way of putting it.
So I have to ask, as someone who has written so extensively nonfiction about this region, did you feel any pressure as a writer writing fictionally about this region?
I have to say that, you know, I was writing Mother of All Pigs, an early draft in the 1990s. So there must have been something in me that was unsure about being, you know, looking at the region through a fictional lens. It took me a long time to, you know, I would write and then I would go back to it. But also the early 1990s, there was one Arab-American writer that had been published, that was Diane Abu Jaber, and that was Arabian Nights. And my vision, even my early vision of the region, was very different from hers. So, you know, we're talking about a time in American publishing and British publishing where there wasn't a lot of Arab writers in translation. So people didn't really look to the region. Maybe it was Naguib Mahfouz, you know, but people weren't really looking at the region or looking at stories, thinking that these stories would be interesting to a wider reading public in the West.
That's so interesting. And I, not only, you know, kind of to Joe's question about you feeling pressure about how you're going to convey this space, but I love what you were talking about earlier when you said you were surprised about how people look at the Middle East through the lens of fiction, as opposed to understanding it from just the small snippets we see on the news. does that, even just this initial part of your book tour, which I know you're just kind of like getting into, has that been kind of inspirational for you to want to continue down this path of writing fiction?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And also those nonfiction anthologies, they were done at a time when in the 2000s, in Britain, for example, very few people were looking at the Middle East through the prism of arts and culture. Mm-hmm. I think there were two women, there was a curator and a Lebanese publisher at the time, and they were my mentors. Now I'm asked to address a conference called Arab Women Artists Now, and I meet a whole generation of young curators, editors, mm-hmm. writers. They all want to do the sort of books that I've been doing, mm-hmm. and I kind of feel like it's time to pass on the baton. Uh-huh. They get to do that, and I'm going to head into fiction. I'm still a little bit, I'm not a really experienced fiction writer, mm-hmm. but I think that it's fine. Mm-hmm. I think that I have ideas, and I think that as outlandish as some of my ideas are in Mother of All Pigs, they still work. So I have confidence in my outlandish approach to things.
I just want to ask, because I don't know that we've ever had anyone on the show that has curated anthologies like you have.
I don't think so.
So I, just from like a craft standpoint, I'm just really fascinated. What is, from your aspect, the person who is curating these, are you finding people that have stories to tell that you know of? Are you thinking of stories that you want specific people to tell? I guess just the idea of how an anthology comes together is really interesting to me.
My anthologies are very specific in that usually I have a relationship with someone very close to the cities that I'm interested in or the countries I'm interested in. And between us, it's not me telling the contributors what they should write for the book. Mm-hmm. I want the contributors to tell me. And I want a wide range of contributors. I want established and unestablished writers. I want artists, photographers. The trouble with the Middle East is we only see it through this reductive prism of the news. And that's a big problem for me because I feel that the wide view is the only way that we're really going to understand the culture. Mm-hmm. And America in particular really needs to understand the culture. And I meet people like in my father's rural post office, mm-hmm. and they're completely fascinated by the Middle East. They mm-hmm. want to know everything about the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And yet the places where they can go to find out the information is quite limited. Mm-hmm. So with my nonfiction anthologies, it was very important for me to make it a platform for a wide range of work, but also for voices. Some of the voices are very established and very well known, mm-hmm. and some of them are unknown voices, but the stories they have are stories that you really shouldn't miss. And that's kind of where I come from in mm-hmm. terms of those nonfiction anthologies. And I guess I, too, like for fiction, I'm interested in those stories that are not normally told about from the region. Mm-hmm. Alongside the grand sweep of yeah. monotheism and, Christian and medieval Islamic theology and, uh-huh. philosophy and this, this wondrous history that we've kind of forgotten mm-hmm. what the Middle East has given to the rest of the world. Yeah. So I kind of want to throw, is everything the pig and the kitchen sink? So it's very layered. And yeah. I also wonder if it's so layered because I spent so much time going back to it,
Yeah, sure.
So I have to wonder, sort of on the subject of America in particular needing to kind of broaden their view, are there resources or books that you would recommend that people look into?
Right now it's very interesting what kind of fiction is coming out of the region. There's a lot of dystopian science fiction coming out of the region, but there's also queer writing coming out of the region. Mm-hmm. And this writing is pretty available across the internet. You just have to look for it, mm-hmm. and it's there. Some of it's being published by very small publishers in English translation. Mm-hmm. But I hear that the big agents are looking at some of the writers. Yeah. So there's something, after 2011, in terms of the Arab Spring / Awakening, There wasn't a great amount of political progress. We still have the dictators in place. We still have the wars going on. But there's a whole generation of young people who have been emboldened mm-hmm. by and empowered by the internet.
Yeah.
And so these voices are coming to the surface, and I think that's very exciting.
It's funny you say that. We actually had something I wanted to ask you about kind of along those lines. You did this really beautiful promotional video for the book where you discuss kind of the stereotype of a Middle Eastern woman. People assume they're kind of downtrodden, but, you know, your family and this story kind of helps shine a light on the fact that that's just not true, and kind of you're not, you know, women in the Middle East aren't just like kind of succumbing to a patriarchy. That's not, you know, how they're living their lives. So I just, because we have this rare opportunity to talk with you, can you kind of like expand upon that, just like what you're seeing from people who are from the Middle East, whether they are artists or just kind of the interactions you know you're one of the people who can kind of explain them.
It's really interesting. There's a generation that's come after the Arab Spring, and Mona Kaf, who's a Syrian poet, she calls them the generation of dissent. The women in this generation of dissent are very active. They're active on all sorts of levels in terms of they're working as activists, for example, too. In Lebanon and Jordan, they pulled back the Marry Your Rapist law, mm-hmm. which were colonial laws that were kind of just adopted by these countries after independence, and they were in force. And it was these feminist activists and also gender activists mm-hmm. that have said, no, we're not going to do that, and really fought to have change. That's also happening in Tunisia, where there are new laws where a Muslim woman can marry the man of her choice. Before, it was illegal for a Muslim woman to marry a man from a different faith. So these things are happening, and they're happening because small groups of activists are challenging, and they're doing a lot of campaigns. And this, too, you can watch on the internet. Mm-hmm. There's also a very interesting Egyptian, Canadian, British sociologist, her name is Shireen El-Fekky. Mm-hmm. She's like the Cher Hyde of mm-hmm. the Middle East. You know, she really looks at sexual mores. Yeah. She just did a survey of 10,000 men and women in Palestine, Lebanon, Morocco, and Egypt. Mm-hmm. And what she found is that young men have attitudes that are more conservative than their parents and grandparents. Mm. However, women of that same age have more progressive attitudes than their parents and grandparents. So where does that leave the young men and women?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are they at loggerheads? Well, El-Fekky says not really, because the men are very keen to work in the home. Also, high rates of unemployment mean that the men are not really fulfilling their duty in a patriarchy, mm-hmm. which is to take care of everybody.
Right.
They're unemployed. So they're taking care of their kids at home. Mm-hmm. And the women, because the women are always, whether we're talking about the West or the Middle East, the lower paid workforce mm-hmm. usually, the women are working. So I find this really interesting that, okay, we can say that the Middle East has this monolithic patriarchy and nothing's changing. And yet there are these women who are like setting fires everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's exciting. It doesn't mean that the Middle East is going to change fast, but there is movement on the ground mm-hmm. that we should acknowledge and celebrate.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going on. And I mean, let's look for a moment at Saudi Arabia. You know, women couldn't drive there. Women still aren't driving, but this new prince, this crown prince, mm-hmm. who seems to be changing everything and maybe starting a war with Iran too at the same time, he says that by next year women are going to be driving. Mm-hmm. So that's a big breakthrough
yeah.
for women in Saudi Arabia. Now, some of the feminist activists I've talked to, they said, oh, this is easy for him to do. It's the liberals inside his country will be happy, and the liberals outside his country will be happy. But does it really mean that women's lives will change? I think when it comes to driving, women's lives are going to change.
Yeah.
So these, you know, looking from afar, looking in, or looking from the inside out, stuff is going on. But also let's talk about the women within families. Mm-hmm. I don't know downtrodden Arab women in my family, Jordanian women in my family.
Mm-hmm.
The women in my family are very vocal,
mm-hmm.
and you want to stay out of their way. Now, so There are young women who are very progressive, but we also have some women who are very conservative too. Mm-hmm. And in the Middle East, there are some generations of women that uphold the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. They're comfortable with it. But things are changing.
My biggest takeaway from that is just, and not only in the Middle East, but like a thing that you're kind of seeing in the United States as well right now is exactly what you say. Activism works. Like it can feel like you're the small person and you aren't, nothing's going to ever change. But if you're diligent and you're willing to, voice your displeasure and have potential solutions and be consistent with it, like exactly what you're saying, like it shows that that is something that works, and that's really inspiring.
But I think what's inspiring for me is the activism of millennials. Mm. They're changing the gender you guys are changing the gender conversations in this country. You're changing stuff. Your group will change. And I think the same with the millennials in the early 30s in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Now, it's hard to change things, for example, in Egypt. Right. I don't know if you heard about the singer who just in passing at a concert said that she wouldn't drink the water from the Nile because she gets sick. Now the government is thinking about prosecuting her for demeaning or saying something against the government. And my reaction is, well, let's have General Sisi in front of the Nile. Let's see him drink some of that Nile water. And so you're right that I've been an activist for a long time. Mm-hmm. My nonfiction work, I see myself as a writer, editor, and activist, mm-hmm. especially my work on Syrian arts and culture. I feel very strongly about Syria. But people don't really think that activism is coming anew again. Mm-hmm. And it's having a younger phase. And that, I think, is very exciting.
Well, I think it sort of goes to what Adam says. It's a long process. Mm-hmm. Activism can be. It starts grassroots, and it can take a long time to see real, long-lasting, permanent mm-hmm. change. And so you just have to keep going and just... Yeah.
But I was told that the millennials are like the baby boomers. They are a big demographic. Mm-hmm. So you started your change like in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Goodness me, let's see where you'll be in the 40s and 50s. Yeah.
Well, and to your point, just again, like to bring it back to the United States, like there's been so many things, and we don't have to get political, but like in this current presidency, there's been so many things that have been tried to be pushed through the House and the Senate. And because there were things that just seemed so egregious and outrageous, there's all this activism on social media and things that are telling people in the millennials, 20s and early 30s, hey, you need to be calling your congressman, you need to be doing, and I'll tell you what, like I can't tell you how many times I have called someone in the last 10 months, and I can tell you that before January of this year the number was zero. I had never once called a congressman because I wasn't outraged and upset. So it's not a great thing to be, to have a situation happen where you're outraged and upset. But if you can create action out of what you see, I will say I think that is something that the younger generation is doing pretty well.
One of the things for Mother of All Pigs that I wanted to do is I wanted to address or explore that generation in the Middle East. What are the options facing? What are the opportunities or the options do they have? And I feel that that's really encapsulated by the cover, the image we have on the cover,
yes.
Which is an artwork by Majd Masri. She's 26. She's a Palestinian artist. She lives in Ramallah. And the image that she has of a woman holding a Kalashnikov with a daisy in her mouth. Mm-hmm. And I feel that's the choice for people in the Middle East, young people. Are they going to pick up arms, or are they really going to look for the daisy, mm-hmm. To transform their society, a peaceful way of change, mm-hmm. And I feel that that's the, but also that image references Naji al-Ali, which was a Palestinian cartoonist, mm-hmm. who had Hamzala, who was this character that always had his back towards the viewer, looking at what was going on in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And I feel that Arab awakening or Arab Spring, if you talk to my aunties, they'll say, oh, didn't do anything, worthless, worthless, worth it, why all that trouble for nothing? But for me, it showed that there's a generation that really is hungry for change. And so I'm curious, one of the things I try to do in Mother of All Pigs is to sort of explore what their lives are like through the character of Samira, the youngest daughter of the family, mm-hmm. the one that didn't emigrate to the United States, the one that stayed with the family in Jordan. And what are the possibilities mm-hmm. for someone like that?
Well, I your book is so good. I love this book so much. I was so blown away that this is like your first, you know, fictional piece, because there's, you know, we've talked a lot about kind of the heavier aspects of this book, but like, in addition to that, you have multiple, you know, points of view and multiple timelines, and on top of all that, it's like there's so much humor in there too, and I just, and that honestly was something that I loved, because, and I love when writers do this, and you did it incredibly. Like, there is a, you know, it's a family, and they're very, you know, it's a family story, and yes, there are hard times that the family deals with, but they each maintain their humor, and that's what makes, to me, the family feel so real, is that's exactly how a lot of people get through tough times. That's how my family gets mm-hmm. through tragedy, is we crack jokes endlessly. So I'm really glad you put that in there. That's so great.
And that black humor, or the humor of the family, has really come out of me hanging out with Syrian activists, Palestinian activists. Mm-hmm. When things are really, really bad, they are so funny. Mm-hmm. And everyone, you know, we're all cracking up. I mean, okay, we should be crying over Syria. But, you know, the Syrians for so long, they were victims of the dictatorship. Mm-hmm. And now they're finally speaking for themselves. Yeah. And they have a lot to say. Yeah. And they're angry, and they're surprised that the people who hold power over them are stupid and so violent. Mm-hmm. So they have something to say about that. And I think that one of the things I really wanted to do for Mother of All Pigs is that I don't really think of myself as a humorous person, but I wanted to have humor there, because humor is something never associated with the Middle East.
Right.
And no, that's true.
That's so crazy. When I'm with my girlfriends in Lebanon, we're on the floor all the time, just screaming and laughing. When I'm with my family in Jordan, I mean, you know, even when I'm with my cousins in Akron, Ohio, they're a pretty funny group. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the disconnect that we have about the region, is that we all think it's, or if you just watch the news, you think it's one way. But if you have connections to family culture, it's really, really different. And I want to try to bring those two things closer together, so people will be surprised, and they will think differently, and they won't see this family story as just an Arab family story, right. But mm-hmm. something a little more universal. Yeah. But I didn't know, that's something that I was thinking of after I wrote it. When I was writing, I was thinking, no, it's got to be this way.
But no, that's something that anyone from any background can relate to, is, you know, families tend to use humor to get through tough times. So
absolutely.
That absolutely loved. Okay, we like to end our podcast on a little bit of a light note. So we have 9 questions that we call the Nerd 9, because we like alliteration.
Okay.
These are lighthearted. I'm losing my voice, so I'm going to let Joe go through these.
Don't overthink these questions. Okay. What is the last book you finished reading?
Oh, the last book that I finished reading was The Cue. It's Basma Aziz, Abdul Aziz. She's an Egyptian writer. This dystopian science fiction.
Mm, that sounds really good.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite place to read?
I have a comfy chair in my office that I sit in and I read there.
Me too.
What book made you fall in love with reading?
You know, when I was 13, my father came home early from work one time, and he dropped the collected works of Ernest Hemingway in my bedroom. And I think it was it was all of those works.
Right.
All that, really. And some of it I didn't understand at 13.
Sure.
So I had to revisit when I was 16 and 17. And that intrigued me also, that that I didn't understand that before, but then I understood it. So what happened in between? I was sort of curious about that.
That's a good point, yeah.
We did, not to cut you off, this is why this never ends up being rapid fire, too. I was getting interested. You're talking about Ernest Hemingway. When I was in, I think I was 17 or 18, I was in high school, and I was in like a AP level English class. We did Hills Like White Elephants, his short story.
Short stories, yeah.
And the first time I read it through, I was like, what is, there's no deeper meaning. This is just a really weird story. And then we went through the whole thing. So
I was the same way. That story particularly, the first time I read it, I did not fully appreciate what he had done as a writer with that story. Yeah. And it took me many years later to really
get it all. I'm also a massive Hemingway fan. Sorry, continue.
Is there one place you would like to travel to that you haven't been to yet?
No, but I've been thinking, because, you know, my mother's Filipino, my father's Jordanian. I've been thinking that I need to spend more time in Manila for work and research, and that's what I've been thinking about. So there isn't a place like, you know, do I want to go to, I've been to Chile. Well, I haven't been to the bottom of Chile, but,
you know, you do seem very well traveled.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Well, I'm the one out of the family that is kind of like, I don't know, my other cousins and they really sort of stay in the United States, and they stay close. Like me, I'm like, oh, no. I haven't lived in the States since the 1980s, so I am very interested. So I'm trying to think, where do I want to go? No, I need to go to Manila. That's what I need to do.
There you go. Do you have a favorite holiday you like to celebrate?
Oh, a favorite? Diwali, the Festival of Lights.
Yeah.
Because when I first moved out of the United States, I lived in Birmingham, which is Britain's second largest city. And that's the first non-white city in the UK. And Diwali is spectacular. It's filled with fireworks, candles, lights, you know, the whole thing. So I like Diwali.
Are you a coffee or tea drinker?
Tea drinker.
Cats or dogs?
Oh, you know, 5 years ago, we never saw a dog on the streets of London. Honest to goodness. We never saw them. They weren't there. And then suddenly handbag dogs became the vogue. We saw a lot of really cute handbag dogs. And now they're gone, and we're seeing really good dogs. Mm-hmm. So I think it's because I lived for so long never seeing dogs. Like, we never saw them. And now they're inhabiting London. And so me and my partner, we always like, wow, look at, oh, yeah, you know, like, because we never saw them before. But I like cats, too.
That's my favorite reasoning for that answer I've ever heard. That was wonderful. I love that.
Do you have a favorite food?
Oh, za'atar. The spice that is in Mother All Pigs. It's thyme with sesame and sumac. And the za'atar that's the best. It's Palestinian za'atar.
I actually, when I finish reading it, I cook all the meals in my house. I made a note to find that in a local grocery store.
Yes, za'atar is really good. And it is actually, it's a condiment. But, you know, Arab grandmothers really do believe that if you give your kids za'atar in the morning, they're smarter. So I like za'atar a lot. I eat a lot of it.
If you could have dinner with one person, dead or alive, who would it be?
Wow, that's hard.
We get yelled at for this one a lot by authors.
No. I've started reading the collected essays of Elizabeth Hardwick, and I would have loved to have had dinner with Elizabeth Hardwick.
That's really
all
good.
Right.
I will let you finish up. I literally am losing my voice entirely.
Just finally, what is one thing you would like readers to take away from reading Mother of All Pigs?
That's a really difficult question, because there are so many layers of it. I guess I'd like them to take away the humor and the idea that women of the region are not downtrodden, that there's more behind the scarf and the niqab than we can ever imagine, and that we should stop being so reductive in our thinking about other people in other places.
That's perfect. Thank you so much for joining us today. It was a blast.
You guys were fantastic.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode from overdrive.com, and our library friends can add these titles to their collections and marketplace.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.